them.
There's good to us. There's good to us. I know the master told me so. I see it on Channel 7. I see it on Channel 9. I see it on Channel 4 and 2 and 5. The rich folks good to us. Poor folks ain't shit. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Everything gonna be different after we die.
Hallelujah. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, community radio in Western Canada. It is now just past 12 o'clock noon Pacific Daylight Time here on the West Coast, and it's time now for Animal Voices. So stand guard. Get ready. Here come the animals.
Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly show that endeavors to increase compassion for all living creatures. Three local societies, Earth Save Canada, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection, and the Vancouver Humane Society, lend their support to make this program possible. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of these three organizations. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me are co-hosts John Pranger and Carl Loskin, and Alan Jensen, our technician. During the next hour, we'll be hearing from Peter Fricker of the Vancouver Humane Society, who will be updating us on the local animal issues, including the BC SPCA cruelty charge against the Greater Vancouver Zoo and animal welfare efforts that are being made to protect exotic animals. In the latter half hour of the program, John Pranger will be interviewing John A. Pippin, who is a cardiologist and a senior medical research advisor with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And he will be talking about artificial sweetener, aspartame, which was recently declared safe for human consumption by a U.S. authority in spite of a research project indicating it is dangerous. We will also be hearing from Carl Loskin on various current topics of interest. Now, Alan, could we just have a little bit of music? Hopefully our Dana Andrews friend. No, not quite ready for that. Yeah. Okay. No, are we okay?
Yeah,
good. Last weekend was a very important one for people who are interested in food, because that was the Taste of Health weekend. Saturday and Sunday, there was a marvelous show all about food that went on. I was there on Saturday and was very impressed with all that was provided in the way of public speaking and demonstrations of food and tasting of food and a lot of literature being handed out. It was really a spectacular on food. It was also a pretty serious event, telling us about the importance of the food we select to eat and how it impacts on the environment, on other animal species, and on our own health. I know Carl Loskin was instrumental in this whole event this year and has been for several years working for the Taste of Health. Carl, how did this year compare with others? Can you tell us?
Well, Marge, it just gets better every year, and the tremendous variety, and they've been at the Croatian Cultural Center for a while, and what I really liked was, Thanksgiving's coming up, and people are looking for alternatives of what they can eat, and I just had some wonderful, I can just, still in my memory, that wonderful portobello mushrooms with breadcrumbs and nuts that was prepared at the food preparing, and also, so that's a wonderful vegan dish that people can prepare. It was almost like a dessert. There was a vegan cheesecake. Alan Munro does that, and there was also Patricia did a wonderful vegan cheesecake that was just totally even the crust was totally vegan. So basically, it's all about something wonderful that everybody can do for themselves, and that is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products.
Yes, indeed, and I was especially impressed with hemp. Now, I've heard about hemp, and it's a bad side for humanity, but I was not nearly aware of all the great things there are in hemp. So nutritious and high in protein and in fats that are not harmful to the body, essential fatty acids and so forth. And I was given a little sample, and I must say it tasted very good, kind of reminiscent to me of sesame seeds. So that I'm going to make a point of using that. I'm breaking myself in gradually to it, using it on cereal. And also flax, of course, which I've used before, but good presentations of these foods, and the speakers too. I was really interested in meeting Ray Sikora, and she was on our program earlier and talked about each of us being a billboard to society by our behavior and by the food we eat, especially. So that I was impressed, and with other speakers as well that told us personal stories that it related to food and their health.
Now, of course, we got Thanksgiving coming up this weekend, so what do we think that most people think of Thanksgiving? And, the Vancouver Humane Society said it with a banner a few years ago, Thanksgiving is murder for turkeys. Well, we wouldn't want to be involved with murder, so we have wonderful vegan alternatives, and people can go to vegsource.com, earthsave.bc.ca, and get wonderful recipes that will make you be kind to the turkeys during this Thanksgiving. You know, more turkeys are eaten during Thanksgiving than at any other time during the year. And there was an article in the Vancouver Sun that showed a barn full of turkeys. It was hardly, at least they weren't in cages, but the farmer was standing in between all these turkeys. There was hardly room for them to even move around. And the headline was, "Turkey farmers look forward to plump sales this year." So, well, we have our own line on that, in that basically that the turkey is indigenous to southern parts of the United States and Mexico. It's a magnificent bird, closely related to partridges and pheasants, and was one of the fastest birds on Earth, which can reach up to 50 kilometers an hour. And, of course, they're being held in these barns. So what's happened that they keep them in barns is that due to genetic engineering and factory farming, the present-day bird actually bears very little resemblance to the original bird. In these barns, up to 100,000 birds are bred. They're heavily breasted because that's what people like to eat, and they can hardly walk or breed and are thus artificially inseminated. Antibiotics and growth hormones ensure that these residues and pesticides make their way into the turkey flesh. Then not only that is the antibiotics in the turkey flesh, and it's pervasive, it's in every part of the turkey. It also has artery-clogging cholesterol, fat, and saturated fat is found even in lean turkey. A 6-ounce portion of turkey without the skin contains 6 ounces of fat and a whopping 274 calories. There is indeed, this Thanksgiving, no free lunch. It is all about making kind choices, and that's what we advocate on Animal Voices.
Sounds very much like the raising of chickens in our society, doesn't it, Carl?
It is indeed, you know, and
so extremely cruel.
Yes. Well, you say it so good. It is extremely cruel. But to me, the most agonizing part of all this is that it is organized cruelty. It is that cruelty that is practiced as an actual matter of social principle or public policy. It is supported on every level of government. Look after our farmers. And it is regarded by the community as a means of a higher goal. The higher goal is, of course, having, you know, it's a good source of protein. We've shown in so many of our programs here that that is false. We don't need these gigantic quantities of protein. We don't need these accumulated levels of pesticides.
Yeah, I'm wondering what would be a good vegetarian non-turkey dinner, Carl? What would you suggest?
Well, I had it this morning. I didn't have my... but, you know, I love steamed pumpkins and steamed yams, and you can grate them up, mm-hmm. and they're just so wonderful. You know, it reminds me of, when they talk about turkeys, they're always and chickens, they're always very concerned about... the bacteria. Well, where does these bacteria come from? These bacteria come from the intestines of these animals. So what happens is that we also mentioned previously on one of our programs here that a study at the University of Arizona found higher levels of coliform bacteria in the American kitchen than on the rim of a toilet. Foodborne Disease Authority Nichols Fox says the bathroom is cleaner because people are not washing their chickens in the toilet. Well, and you know, the same applies to turkeys at this time, and the Vancouver Humane Society has said in some of its editorials, Thanksgiving is murder for turkeys, but it doesn't have to be. Keep listening to Animal Voices. We have viable alternatives.
Thank you for that, Carl. And now we have Peter Fricker of the Vancouver Humane Society on the air, on our line, rather. And he is the Project and Communications Director for the Vancouver Humane Society. Welcome, Peter. Are you there? Hello, Peter.
Hi, Marge. Thank you.
Hi. Nice to have you back. Peter, I know that you're always working on multiple programs, one of them that you have been working on for some time is the exotic animal issue. And I know you doubtlessly have been following up on Hazina, the hippopotamus with the Greater Vancouver Zoo, and her terrible plight existing in that small pen, concrete pen that she had. And would you give us a little background on this and then tell us what is happening with the lawsuit that the SPCA was instrumental in getting the zoo charged with?
That's right. I think your listeners will remember that back in the early part of the summer, the Greater Vancouver Zoo was charged with cruelty under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act following an investigation by the SPCA, which was prompted by a complaint from VHS concerning Hazina's conditions at the zoo. And as I'm sure your listeners will also know from the television and radio coverage that followed, that Hazina had been kept in some quite appalling conditions for about 19 months in that very small barn and also kept alone there. There have been a number of adjournments to the court dates that have been set for the Greater Vancouver Zoo to face these charges. Most recently, it's been adjourned to October the 18th, so we're hoping that something will get started then. Of course, we don't know the outcome. It's quite possible that the charges could be stayed or that the Crown could lose the case. We don't know. Obviously, we're looking for a positive outcome for Hazina and for mm-hmm. the zoo to be held to account for her care.
Can you tell us what the charges actually are?
It's two counts of cruelty to animals under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act, which is a provincial statute.
Mm-hmm.
And it relates to her treatment there.
And the shelter, the type of shelter they provided for her that was totally inadequate. I suppose that's
right.
A large part of it.
That's right. What what we don't know is whether the evidence that the SPCA has gathered in the case they've made will be strong enough under current BC law to for these charges to stick. I mean, obviously, we're hoping that they do.
It had to go through the Crown Council, I think, before the charge could be laid, didn't it?
That's right. Crown Council actually officially lays the charges.
I see. So I should think it's their responsibility to make sure the charges are well-founded. Is it?
That's right. But it'll be up to the court to decide whether there's a strong enough
case against them. Yes,
yeah.
I see. Yeah.
The difficulty that we're concerned about is that there isn't very strong legal protection for exotic animals in British Columbia. There are currently no zoo regulations or standards for exotic animals, so they have very little legal protection.
Is that true of the rest of Canada, or does it vary from one province to the other?
It does vary from one province to the other, and BC and Ontario are probably the worst in that they have virtually no protection for exotic animals, no regulation of zoos, no standards or inspections. Basically, a zoo can keep an exotic animal in any way it wishes. It's somewhat different for native species. They're covered under the Wildlife Act in BC and are therefore afforded some protection, and the ministry can investigate the way animals are being kept.
Well, wasn't there some talk about the Greater Vancouver Zoo, which is in Aldergrove, in case our listeners aren't aware of that, of losing its permit?
That's possible, but that permit only applies to their keeping of indigenous species.
Oh, really?
At the moment, they do have a permit, as we understand it, and nothing they do in terms of exotic animals would affect the validity of their permit.
Really?
Yeah.
So
that's the problem.
What we
are looking for, and especially if the zoo doesn't have to face these charges, if the charges are stayed or if the case is lost, one of the things we'll definitely be doing is going after the provincial government to put in proper regulations and, if necessary, legislation to ensure that these animals do get the protection that they require.
Now, this is another, this is just the broader issue, isn't it, of exotics, and the zoo issue is kind of a focal point, but there is a lot of issues with exotic creatures, capture, importation, selling, keeping, all of these things I know are a concern to the Vancouver Humane Society, and now you're talking about this should be a provincial issue.
That's true, because at the moment, all there really is in BC and across Canada generally is a patchwork of municipal legislation, bylaws, that in some cases give some protection to some exotic animals. But unfortunately, in BC, there's only a handful of municipalities that have such laws, and unfortunately, the city of Vancouver is one of the municipalities that has no exotic animal bylaw.
So why has this been a local issue with several municipalities? Why haven't animal welfare groups gone directly to the provincial government or the federal government?
Well, it seems that both the federal and provincial levels of government have wanted to wash their hands of this issue and have decided to pass it on down to the municipal level and leave individual towns and cities to decide what they want to do about it. Of course, it would be better if there were provincial or federal legislation, but they just don't want to go anywhere near it. So we've had to focus on trying to get individual councils to address the issue, and in some cases there has been support, usually, unfortunately, prompted by an incident in which a large animal, a snake or something like that, has made the news, and people have got concerned about public safety and exotic animals. Then, in some cases, these municipalities will act. And unfortunately, it hasn't happened yet in Vancouver.
They would feel a lot of pressure if it were public safety, wouldn't it? A lot more than they would for animal welfare.
That's right. It's usually the debate around this centers on three issues. One is animal welfare, which of course is the one we're most interested in, but also exotic animals do present health public health problems. For example, reptiles carrying salmonella. Or public safety problems, and that's with some of the larger or venomous species that can obviously be a danger to the public.
Now, I know that you have been working on this issue for some time, and you have gone to the local government. Mm-hmm. And how are you working on that? Can you tell us what's happening and so on?
Yes, we've been talking to the City of Vancouver for some time, and we are very hopeful that things are moving in the right direction in terms of an exotic bylaw. We have consulted with the city staff, and they have also talked to a number of other groups, including the BCSPCA, about the need for a bylaw. And we understand that the staff there, the bylaw staff, will be producing a report for council most likely this month, at which point council will consider that report and then open up the issue to public consultation. And if that does happen this month or sometime this year, we're hoping that the humane community will make themselves aware of the issue and make their views known to the council.
There is quite a strong business lobby, isn't there, in favor of having exotic animals?
Yes, usually the opposition to these kinds of bylaws comes from the pet industry, large pet store chains, that kind of thing. And clubs and enthusiasts who like to think that they should have the right to own any animal they want, in particular any reptile they want. And they are, you know, a very strong voice for the other side, and mm-hmm. we expect this issue to be very controversial.
I see. Well, we know the reptiles are a huge problem, aren't they, in the Lower Mainland because of the Rainforest Reptile Refuge and the bulging at the seams that it suffers constantly.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that many people go out to stores, pet stores, or through the Internet or through classified advertising, obtain various kinds of reptiles, take them home and discover that they don't have the ability or the equipment or the expertise to care for these animals, and they end up either getting sick or dying or being abandoned or in some cases turned over to the reptile refuge. And, of course, we'd like to see a stop put to all of that.
Sure. Now, you have had some successes, haven't you, in the Lower Mainland already with your campaigning for or what your project
right.
to get legal bylaws set up. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, there are a number of municipalities in BC that have these kinds of bylaws. North Vancouver, for example, Abbotsford, Courtney, Kelowna. In fact, the entire central Okanagan regional district have bylaws to deal with exotics. In the Lower Mainland, there's also Richmond and Surrey have passed exotic animal bylaws, but they only prohibit the sale of these animals and not the ownership. And what we're looking for with Vancouver and the other municipalities is to get a comprehensive bylaw that would prohibit both the sale and ownership, because, frankly, it's pointless to have a ban on sale when people can simply go to another municipality or turn to the Internet to buy their animals and simply bring them back to their home municipality.
Now, did you say that Kelowna had a two-part bylaw that would cover both?
Or, yes. Kelowna has a bylaw that deals with both ownership and sale.
So they have been a little more progressive on that issue, haven't they?
Yes, and we're really pleased with that. We think it's a model bylaw, and we have, of course, referred the city staff in Vancouver to that bylaw and some of the other ones across the country. It's worth noting that in other major cities in Canada, such as Ottawa, Toronto, and Winnipeg, they do have exotic animal bylaws. So Vancouver is really the odd man out in terms of dealing with this issue.
I see. Well, that's worth knowing. Now, so there are a couple of issues coming up, the court case and the hearing at the City Hall, I guess, about the legislation. Tell us what you'd like the public to do.
Well, people need they can go to our website and learn the background of the issue, and that's www.vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca. And they can make their views known to the media on either of these issues, and to the council.
Okay, and the council. Good. Okay, and now if somebody doesn't have a computer, where should he call for information?
You can call us at 604-266-9744.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's wonderful, Peter. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For being with us.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to an interview with Peter Fricker, who is the project's coordinator for communications with the Vancouver Humane Society. And now could we have some music, Alan, please?
Won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Well, if anyone's to blame, it's old Saddam Hussein. They met at a peace dance in the war. They built a little shack with the forest just out back, and that's where they learned what love is for. Whoa, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Well, someone said to me, hey, life ain't just easy. There's ups and downs and things that can go wrong. There's wars, disease, and death, credit cards, and morning breath. Those nights the playoffs won't come in on your TV. Oh, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. In old times we roamed the land, hunter-gatherer clans. We shared the jobs and joys of this good life. Now we're your family and your close community. You should always call on us when you need help. Whoa, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. May you have so many friends, may your laughter never end, may the rising river never reach your house. May you dance all night long to that sweet romantic song, may you always have a crush upon your spouse. Oh, won't you please take my friends on a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Oh, won't you please take my friends for a wild, happy ride through that open countryside where it's so good to be alive, where the ocean meets the sand in our green, rainy land. Take this woman and this man for a wild, happy ride. Take this woman and this man.
For that, Alan. Sorry about the misintroduction. That was Dana Lyons with Wild Happy Ride. Now we're going to turn the mic over to John Pranger for his interview.
Thanks, March. And you're listening to Animal Voices, 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. On the line, we have cardiologist John A. Pippin, who is a medical doctor and a senior medical and research advisor with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He wrote an article titled, Artificial Sweetener Studies Underscore the Risk of Relying on Animal Testing. And this article was published in the Charlton Gazette of April 23rd, 2006. Well, we've heard a lot lately in the news about the FDA assuring us that aspartame was a safe addition to our food, and that those studies that were conducted by Italian researchers had no value at all. Dr. Pippin, can you sort that out for us? How is the lay public supposed to understand these things?
Well, that's a great question. I was hoping you'd have the answer. I sure don't. Here's the basic problem. I think I can sort it out for you, but the basic problem is that our media, not just in America, but Canada and everywhere else, are very ready to jump on every apparent new miracle breakthrough in medicine. Those are hot stories. Those are things everybody wants to see. And, of course, the people who do this research, largely animal research, are only too eager to get that information into the public media because it supposedly emphasizes the critical nature of the work they do and the need to support it. Well, the problem is that when citation analyses and systematic reviews have been done that look at reports of critical medical breakthroughs that show up on television, on the radio, in newspapers, in popular magazines, and so on, if you then track those results into human studies, they blow up. There's almost no return on that animal research, and I'll pose a question to your listeners. Think about how often you hear about or see news about a fantastic breakthrough due to animal research, such as, well, the aspartame thing. You know, we found that aspartame causes blood cancers, lymphomas and leukemias in these rats. Therefore, it's a cancer risk for humans. Think about how often you see that, and then think about how often you ever see a follow-up study telling you what happened when they test that in humans. And the reason for that is it almost never works. The failure rate is phenomenal. And people are then left with the false impression that all these miraculous breakthroughs in animals are contributing to human health, when in fact it's a big fraud. They're doing no such thing. And that's the problem. Now, the aspartame issue, you know, we went through this with saccharin, too. Remember, some years back, that was an issue. But
right.
Italian scientists decided to look at whether feeding aspartame to rats would cause any cancer.
So I'd like to know why they do that anyway. I mean, if the safety has been proven already, why doesn't the answer rest?
Well, the answer seldom rests in medical science. There's always new information to be obtained, and just think how often what we think we knew turns out to be false. So there's always research going. The question, your question is exactly right, but it should be, why do we do this in rats? Why don't we find ways to look at this in people, because we're interested in people? But rats are cheap and easy, and you can get funding to do it, and you can get it published in papers and magazines and journals, and if it doesn't work in people, that's not your fault. So they took these 1,800 rats, 900 males, 900 females, they gave them a bunch of aspartame, and they found out that, sure enough, there were more lymphomas and leukemias, these blood cancers, in the rats that got the aspartame. But guess what? It was only in the males. I mean, only in the females.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't in the males. And that alone tells you there's something screwy, because if it's different between male and female rats, what in the heck is it going to have to do with humans?
No.
The same thing happened with saccharin. They found out that saccharin causes bladder cancers in the offspring of rats that were given saccharin, but only in the males. So you've got aspartame in females and saccharin in males, and both of them don't cause cancer in humans. So it's a big fraud.
Now, that doesn't mean to say that aspartame is healthy just because of these studies. I mean, we're talking only about cancer now. There may be lots of problems with, and lots of problems are reported. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah. There's still, I think, an honest debate going on about other potential ill effects of aspartame, particularly in people who are sensitive to it. I think if you're talking about population-wide, aspartame really is generally safe. But it seems pretty clear that there's a subgroup of people who are sensitive to this chemical, and that it produces changes in the brain, changes in the nervous system that can lead to what's called aspartame disease or aspartame syndrome. And I've had friends and patients who, during periods of time when they were heavily drinking diet beverages, had these symptoms, and they went away when they stopped drinking the beverages.
That's so, right.
So you're right. It certainly does that in some people. And I think if people, for your listeners who drink a lot of diet beverages or put aspartame, which is NutraSweet or Equal, in a lot of their beverages or on their cereal or whatever, if they start having these neurological type symptoms, then they should just cut that out of their diet, and it may all go away.
Well, I downloaded some statements by people who had been affected, they think, by aspartame, and the first three that came up were from people who drank 24 to 30 Diet Cokes a day. Can you imagine? And they had, well, I don't know what kind of problems they have. I'd have to have a look at that. Another one, bags of Splenda, and she would put it in all her food. I eat it like crazy, she says. I put it in everything. When they came out with the large bags, I guess I started putting it in so many of my foods, and then she finally decided to quit eating it, but she couldn't stop eating it, so she had to cut down. Another, the other one had colitis, but she was also drinking huge amounts of Diet Pepsi.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's not that... it seems to me that these are extremes, and you can get any kind of complaints from living in such extreme ways.
Well, sure. The examples that you've mentioned are people who are way outside the norm in terms of how much of this they consume. Mm-hmm. And it's a very well accepted principle in medicine and science in general that enough of any substance will cause side effects or toxicity. You can even drink too much water. You can
sure.
go into a coma from drinking too much water. So out on the extremes, I think you have to wonder, well, is this just overloading the system? But it's also true that people who really don't consume very much in the way of diet beverages or don't use a lot of NutraSweet or Equal or Sweet and Low or these artificial sweeteners can still have symptoms that will go away if they stop using it. And I think this in general, I don't think there's any conspiracy at work here, but I think just in general, when you have these kinds of symptoms, people have been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and undergone all kinds of treatment and tests and expensive things, and then it all went away when they stopped drinking diet beverages. So I think you just have to know your own body and know what you're putting into it, and if you're one of those people who is sensitive to this, just get it out of your diet and you may get back on an even keel. But I don't think it's that different in that regard from a lot of other chemicals we put in our body. Everybody is sensitive to something.
How's your dog, by the way?
Oh, actually, I have 10 dogs.
10 dogs?
Believe it or not.
Oh, I see a little beagle in the picture, your photograph.
Yeah, that's Bonnie. She's passed on, unfortunately. But, yeah, I'm an animal lover.
Yeah. Well, they make good research subjects, of course, dogs.
Yeah, well, I believe anyone who came toward my dogs with that in mind would have some concerns.
Well, now, Doctor, how do you think that we should understand this? Should we understand that from clinical studies, and these were done by the NCI, right?
National
Cancer Institute.
Right.
They conducted a huge epidemiological study. And that's on people, and so that ought to clear things up. And so the case must be rested now, surely.
I think it is. Although it's generally easy to do animal studies on anything you want to, because regulatory bodies and sponsoring bodies don't have any regard for animals. They consider them throwaway commodities.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be hard now, given the overwhelming, this was 566,000 people.
Half a million people.
Who were studied using epidemiological approaches. So this matter has been put to rest. Regarding the cancer issue, it would be very hard for anyone to open that door again.
Will there still be more research going on in that vein, though?
Well,
I mean, is that just the momentum things have?
I haven't heard of anything.
Okay.
I think it's pretty much, I think that issue regarding aspartame is pretty well wrapped up. It's hard to imagine what could be done in people that would be more definitive than what the National Cancer Institute did, and the results were very clear.
And you say that 100 years of widespread use have shown safety for saccharin.
Well, not just 100 years of widespread use, not 100 years in the U.S., but in Europe. It's been around a much shorter time in the U.S., but last time I counted, over 30 clinical studies showing no link between saccharin intake at any level and cancer risk. And I think that's a done deal, too. Now, I'm not saying people some people aren't sensitive to saccharin. Sure they are. But I don't think there's anything outside of some anecdotal information suggesting any link between any of the artificial sweeteners, as far as I know, and risk for cancer.
My co-host has a question for you.
Dr. Pippins, you know, there were congressional hearings about aspartame, and at that time there were about 100 different, it was in about 100 different products, and subsequently it's in approximately 5,000 different products. And what was, this was produced by a very well-known company called Monsanto, is that correct?
I don't recall who makes
Surly.
It offhand.
Now, according to this article, which I have here from the New York Times, it said that Monsanto funds, amongst others, the American Diabetes Association, the American Dietetic Association, the Conference of the American College of Physicians, and that these associations cannot criticize any additives or convey their link to Monsanto because they take money from the food industry and have to endorse their products. And this was maybe underscored here with one of our co-hosts here, Rafe Mayer, who is a diabetic, and he was talking about, in many of his programs, very annoyed at the Canadian Diabetes Association, who were promoting promoting these artificial sweeteners. And he said from personal experience that he knew that this was having a bad effect on his diabetes.
Well, the big point you make about the link between pharmaceutical industries, drug makers, chemical makers, food producers, and various companies that use their products is absolutely correct. And as you know, I can't speak for Canada, but certainly in the U.S., we have entered an era in the last 10 to 15 years when really the driving force in almost everything we do is whatever the related business interest is. Businesses really have insinuated themselves, because they have so much money, into everything around them, and the pharmaceutical industry and chemical and food industries and farming industries are certainly primary among them. And there's a huge uproar in the U.S. going on, an issue of medical ethics, regarding the tremendous influence that drug companies literally buy with the Food and Drug Administration. They provide funding for the FDA, and they demand a return on their investment. Now, that's outrageous, a federal agency having to negotiate with the industry they regulate. They they spend huge amounts of money campaigning doctors to promote their products. They use direct-to-consumer advertising, which the FDA is very tolerant about, and they have even been caught routinely now submitting false data for publication in professional journals. It's a horrible situation, and the Monsanto thing is a little piece of that, but there are much worse examples than that, and a lot of this is coming out in the lawsuits surrounding drugs like FenFen and Vioxx and Regulin and others that have killed people. So yes, you're correct. But the issue of diabetics using artificial sweeteners is more complex, because in fact, for most people with diabetes, if you sweeten your food or sweeten your beverages, you still would be better off using an artificial sweetener than sugar, because the artificial sweetener is not, for the large majority of people, going to have any adverse influence on your diabetes. Admittedly, some people will be sensitive to it. Again, But as a general rule, if you're going to sweeten your food and you're a diabetic and you're supposed to limit your sugar, your glucose intake, then it's not a bad option. So there's a balance there. It's not all good or all bad. Each person has to see what works best for them.
There's always fruit juices and stevia, which is a wonderfully sweet herb. So anyway.
There are many substitutes for, even for these substitutes. I mean, sure. Honey is a good food. Sun-dried organic sugar cane is a very good food, I think. I don't think it would cause diabetes. White sugar, on the other hand, is very nasty stuff. And,
anything that has a high glycemic index and is converted to glucose in the body potentially could raise the blood sugar of someone who already is diabetic. So I think the key is to have a doctor you trust who you can talk with in a straightforward manner and find out what works best for you. A lot of diabetics can use various kinds of sugar products in moderation and can regulate their diabetes anyway. Other people really can't tolerate using those products and they have to look for alternatives. So as in everything we do in medicine, it's not all or nothing, but the nature of it does get complicated by the fact that everyone has a proprietary interest in one way or another, and it's hard for normal people, patients, and consumers to dig through that and find out what the truth is.
Now, you say in your article that the Food and Drug Administration has reported that 92% of drugs that test successfully in animals fail during human trials.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
I mean, shouldn't that sound in huge alarm bells?
You would think that would be in big letters in Times Square or something. That yeah. This whole industry of using animals to do research, to develop drugs to give to people to treat human diseases is just, it's so incomprehensible that you just wonder how it goes on. The Food and Drug Administration has admitted time after time and has published data showing that for every 100 drugs that are tested in animals and shown to be both safe and effective, 92 of them are not going to work or are going to be too unsafe to use in people. In other words, you're almost guaranteed that your animal tests are going to be wrong. So why in the world would you do them? And regarding the cancer issue, you know, this testing rats for cancer with aspartame, of all drug categories tested in animals, the one with the highest failure rate in humans is cancer drugs, and the failure rate for cancer drugs is 95%. Now, where else in the world, John, would we tolerate a 95% failure rate regarding something that has to do with life and death in humans? And yet we tolerate it with animal testing because people don't understand it and they trust the people who tell them that it's essential. And it's a fraud. I used to be an animal researcher. I'm not some, you know, bomb-throwing guy standing on the sideline. I'm a medical doctor.
You leave that to me.
I have done animal research in my career many years ago. I'm not proud of it, but, you know, I learned.
Yes.
And knowing from the inside out what goes on and also knowing results and statistics and keeping track of this and dealing with the FDA and the drug companies myself, I can tell you it's a huge fraud.
Excuse me, I have a bit of a cold. Does that mean that the war on cancer has been lost, and for how many years?
Oh, my God.
Will it be lost forever?
Well, our President Nixon declared war on cancer in 1971, and he said, we're going to cure cancer in our lifetime. Hmm. Well, the war on cancer was focused almost entirely on developing treatments for cancer using testing in animals. I just read recently that government estimates are that over $200 billion, that's with a B, $200 billion has been spent, taxpayer money, on cancer research under the auspices of the war on cancer between 1971 and 1991, when they basically threw their hands up and say, we lost. And out of that came the following. Zero cures for cancer. Zero. Not one. Not even one. Out of 20 years and $200 billion. Second of all, the rate of cancer occurrence in Americans did not decline. It was level. the cancer death rate as a percentage of overall death rate increased during the war on cancer. Cancer is now has now moved past heart disease and is the number one cause of death in Americans under the age of 85. And this is what we got for $200 billion, 20 years of effort, tens of millions of animals killed, and all that lost hope from people waiting for cures for their cancer. And that's what I mean when I say it's a big fraud. And this isn't me talking. The government admits that they lost the war. John Baylor, who was the director of the War on Cancer, has testified to Congress and to presidential commissions. Listen, we lost the war on cancer because we didn't fight it the right way. And he said we should not have spent the money on animal research. We should have spent it on prevention.
Really? Yes.
And prevention is the key, because the best estimates we have are that at least three-quarters, maybe 80% of all cancers in people are related to diet and environment. We give ourselves cancer just like we give ourselves heart disease. We're not going to find the answers by looking at animals.
And yet all these, like the Canadian Cancer Society is already planning its runs for next year because, you know, for research and for the cure. But I don't suppose it'll ever come, because they're counting on that money forever and ever.
Well, one of the things I always ask when I get in debates with scientists about this, and they say, you know, this is our only hope for cures, and I say, well, we've been doing animal research in human diseases by law for over a half century now. Where are the cures for any cancers? Name one for me, please. Where are the cures for any cancers?
Well, they always bring up childhood leukemia.
Childhood leukemia was cured with drugs that were developed before animal testing was required. So you are hard-pressed. Even the director of the National Cancer Institute in the 1980s said, we have not cured a single cancer with our animal tests. This is no big secret. But here's the key, John. The key is that the cure is always where? Right around the corner.
Yeah.
Right around the corner. We have got now these genetically modified mice. We're going to do all our experiments all over again, and we're going to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people don't know any better. The public is not evil. The public is being duped. They have to trust scientists because it's all too complex, and they don't trust folks like you and me because they see us as outsiders. But we are gradually gaining ground, and eventually this is going to happen. We are going to get to a point where we replace the use of animals with better methods, and already we're... let me give you an example. Just 2 weeks ago, I got information about the first ever cure for widespread disseminated melanoma, which you know is a deadly skin cancer, in humans. Two men with melanoma, widespread in their bodies, in their lungs, in the brain, in their bones, who were cured. In other words, cannot find the disease anywhere. That has never happened. That has never happened in over 40 years of concentrated animal research against melanoma and other immune-related cancers. And this was done without using animals. It was done by drawing their blood, by attaching a viral vector that tells their cancer-fighting cells what to look for when they attack the cells. They get the markers off the cancer cells from the patients themselves, and re-injecting that blood, and then what they've got is supercharged immune cells that go attack the cancer cells and leave their own normal body cells alone. And for the first time ever, we have cures of widespread metastatic melanoma, and it was done using people's own blood, their own immune systems, and not one animal.
I have one last question before we have to go, Doctor. Do animals suffer in cancer research?
You know, I can't even begin to tell you how much they suffer. This is why researchers do not want to let you in their labs. Nobody wants to let you see what's going on. I did animal research, and I happened to work in an environment where we were as absolutely humane as we could be. We took excellent care of the animals we use. I happen to use dogs. And even under the best of circumstances, they suffered so much that sometimes we just sat down and cried. There just is, when you say, you cannot say humane animal research. There is no such thing. Trust me, I've done it, I've seen it. I've been involved on the inside and the outside for a quarter century. There is no humane animal research. These animals suffer horribly.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pippin.
You're welcome.
It's been a real pleasure, and I hope to talk to you again.
Okay, anytime.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Thank you for that, John. You have been listening to an interview with Dr. John A. Pippin, who's with the Doctors for Responsible Medicine. And I guess we're just about at the end of our show. I would like to thank you for listening to Animal Voices on CFRO 102.7 FM and invite you to please listen again next Friday, 12 to 1. Bye-bye.
It's Co-op Radio's Fall Member Drive, October 12th to October 29th. 18 days of specials, giveaways, and heartfelt appeals to you, the listeners, to...
Give us your money!
You'll hear special programs on political issues like racial profiling, the people's struggles in Latin America, the proposed unified Canada-US-Mexico fortress state, and Noam Chomsky on Israel's war in Lebanon. So tune in to 102.7 FM, phone in to 604-684-8494, and pitch in with a pledge or a membership to help keep Co-op Radio on the air.
Give us your money.
Give us your money.
Give us your money.